This interview is with Mr. Bruce Nesbitt, the present director of the Afro-American Culture Center at the University of Illinois. Mr. Nesbitt has lived here his whole life. He was born on November 14, 1932, here in Champaign. This interview is being conducted on August 4, 1983, at the Afro-American Culture Center, 708 South Matthews, Urbana. The interviewers are Melinda Roundtree and Patrick Tyler, representing the Urbana Free Library Archives Department. Tape is part one of a two-part series.
Okay, first of all, Mr. Nesbitt, could you tell us your birthday and where you're born?
Okay, my name is Bruce Nesbitt, and I was born in Champaign, Urbana. And I was born November the 14th, 1932. And I've been in Champaign, Urbana since, except for a tour in the service, which was in 1953 through 56.
Okay, could you tell me a little bit about your childhood growing up in Champaign, Urbana? Some experiences that you can remember?
Well, I went to Marquette School, which was a integrated school because there was only three blacks attending above my matriculation, and we constituted that integration segment. I went through to Marquette K through 6, and I went to Marquette basically because of the geographical outlay for the four schools. It seemed to me that the majority of blacks during that time went to Willard School or transferred from Lawhead School, which was Willard was only a block and a half from Marquette School. As I grew older, I guess I belonged to the Boy Scout troop here in Champaign, Troop 11. I spent quite a few years of my young life with the Boy Scouts. I guess I went as far as a Life Scout, three merit badges from a Life Scout during that time. And then I went to Champaign Central High School, where I participated in sports up until my junior year, basketball and football. And I just gave up sports. My senior year in high school was probably my best year academically. One of my disappointments in high school is the fair fact that having passed the criteria to graduate, I did not fulfill the requirement to enter college here at the University of Illinois because rhetoric was one of those requirements. And counselors in those days never suspected that blacks would even be interested in going to high school, so they didn't inform you or gear you toward or prepare you for college. But I was very determined about that, so I extended another semester. I took some art courses and rhetoric just to put myself in that position. I started working as early as junior high school. My first job being a dishwasher at the Inman Hotel, where my father was chef for 35 years. But he thought that I should grow in that kind of business and start at the bottom. I spent 2 years washing dishes, I spent another 2 years being a busboy. And then it was quite an achievement to become a waiter full time. But I've had a good work background. I was taught very young that this is a means of assisting in building on families, that everybody participates at every opportunity to bring money into the household. So I've been working ever since. In reference to my academic background, I chose not to enter college, even after going back to take rhetoric. And instead, I entered the service. I spent my time in service in the 61st Field Artillery Battalion of the 1st Cavalry Division. And I left service as a sergeant. Now, my experience in the service was based around two or three things. I was an athlete. I played baseball and boxed while I was in the service. I was also a gunner with the 105 Howitzer Division. And then the remainder of my time in the service, I spent as a troop information officer. And helped disseminate the news from overseas to the troops as far as updating the newspaper, what was going on across the country, in America. I say in America because my tour was in, briefly, in Korea, and then the remainder in Japan. When I got out of the service, I, of course, went back to work, contemplated going back into service, but I found out I had to go back to Korea to extend the tour of duty before I could get back to Japan, so that disallowed that. But since then, I was a janitor at the Champaign National Bank in Champaign, of course. I was a driver for Bongard's Pharmacy. And I left there and was on the police department in Champaign from 65, or 64 through 69, and I retired from the police department and commenced to work at the University of Illinois. Since then, I've worked at the university here. The initial capacity was as a director of campus community relations of the student services office. Since then, I transferred to the directorship of the Afro-American Cultural Program, whereas I'm still here.
Okay, could you give me a little more information about your family background, your parents' name, and their occupations, and if you can remember why they came to Champaign and what year?
All right, my father, I'm going to be strapped for the years exactly, but I do know that my father come from Little Rock, Arkansas, and my mother's roots, I believe, was in Tennessee. However, well, not really, her family's roots was in Tennessee, because my mother was born in Homer, Illinois, strangely enough, but they was migrating from the South and selected Champaign, Urbana as a site. My father had come previous to my mother's arrival. He had came to Champaign when he was 12 or 13 years old. Too fat to work. And I think most blacks was headed towards Chicago, but that being the paradise for or the illusion for the fact that there was employment there, but stopped along the way en route to Chicago. Now, I do believe that my father came here in 1918, something about 1918 sticks in my mind. That's when when he had came. I'm from a family of 11. Okay. And I lost a sister, two brothers. So the family has dwindled somewhat. But my mother's name is Pauline Nesbitt. My father's name was Herbert Ernest Nesbitt. And we've all, except mother, worked in various capacities. In Champaign, Urbana. My sisters now, I have two sisters out away, one in Louisville, Kentucky, one in Chicago, and the rest of the family is here in Champaign, Urbana.
Could you give us the names of your sisters and brothers?
Yes. I have a sister named Sandra, another sister named Janet, Mary Jean, and brothers named William, Clarence, deceased is Herbert and Paul Ronald. And Hilda, being one of the sisters. Thank you, it's a large family. Thank you, I got them all. I believe that I've got them all. You know. I'm leaving out. Leave it.
I was wondering, okay, during the 50s, along those years, some people had to provide housing for the black students who couldn't be housed at the U of I. Did your family take in any students?
Right. One of the things that our family done during that time as far as taking in students and trying to house and feed them was my dad was working fairly close with the black football players in particular from the university, and so he housed them. One person specifically would be J.C. Caroline, who still remains in Champaign. J.C. was a All-American player here at Illinois, and he spent 1 year in Canada playing football, and then the remainder of 10 years he spent with the Chicago Bears. Now, J.C. and me are very much like brothers. I haven't shared that experience with the number of people that was in our household. Me and J.C. slept in double bunk beds, so he become very much part of the family. A couple of more names to be mentioned, I guess, as far as people that stayed with us was Abe Woodson, Hugh Woodson. There's a kid named Jefferson. I don't think that we took in any girls in the house that stayed with us. But a lot of university kids would spend time over to the house. There's one thing, I guess because of the largeness of our family, we had We had a handle on knowing a whole lot of people, or a whole lot of people knowing us because of the number of us probably in Champaign, Urbana, and expanded over to the campus. I used to visit over on the campus quite a bit. I spent a lot of time at the Illini Union. I went to the sorority and fraternity houses on campus because at that time the campus and community was a very integral part of campus life because of the housing discrimination on campus. So you got a chance to meet a lot of students, and they in turn meeting you.
Yes. Where did you live, you know, during this time? Where was your house located?
Okay, I lived in two places in Champaign, at 408 East Church. That's where I spent my early childhood. And then the remainder of the time at 503 North I Street, whereas my mother still lives there. As we refer to it as headquarters, okay? But she's been there for a number of years.
Okay, during the time that you were on police force, I understand that you were the only black, right? The only black policeman?
Yeah, at one time there was a period in there that I was the single black policeman in Champaign.
Could you tell us some of the experiences?
Yeah, well, it was a very different, very strange relationship, but I knew where I was at all times, and I got along fine with the majority of the personnel. But one of the things that I'd recommend was that I had the opportunity to work in the area of my people, the North End. I probably prefer working there because I'd always subconsciously or consciously believe that white police officers in a black community misused that community, and I would be there firsthand to kind of regulate some of that misuse. I always supposed that these things would not occur if I was in the car or on that particular beat. And that was one of the things that I requested to work the North End. And most of my tour on the police department over the 4-year period was I worked from 11 to 7, 11 at night to 7 in the morning, when most of the activity, especially on the weekends, was going on. So I had a chance to firsthand see that for 3 years. You know, of the two, I never worked the day shift much at all. And primarily worked Northeast Champaign. That was very important to me. And I got my wish. I was there during the time that the gangs were running. I was in a very precarious position because now my feelings about a job is whatever the job may be, you do the job well and you do it according to the rules of the job. You weren't a very popular person being a policeman. And you weren't a very popular person being a black policeman in the black community. But then I wasn't getting paid for popularity. I think that I conducted myself in such a manner that I was respected, and that's all I ever asked for as a policeman in the North End community. And certainly there was times when you hated to arrest a person or having known that individual. But then the job is a job. What you try to do was minimize the effect of the arrest, and still, if there was a crime committed, address it the gang experience, I spent a lot of time talking to the various gang and their gang leaders. And if you talk to one gang more than you do the other gang, there's always that little bit of dissension. But overall, I take great pride in the fact that I was able to talk to the gang leaders. I was able to take and convene them at the police station to discuss why all this foolishness of killing one another, especially the black population. You know, blacks was not the enemy. Okay, so I spent a lot of time explaining that, and the whole ridiculous attitude of shooting at one another, the whole ridiculous attitude of being in crime, because it leads to nowhere. One of the things that I spent a lot of time doing was talking to young people that was on the streets during the curfew. And the curfew then was more in effect. I mean, you're 16 years old, you're out at 11 o'clock, you was in trouble. But then it was more than just arresting them. I was really opposed to just arresting a young person. I'd take him home first and try to explain to him the reason for this law. Now, if you continue to violate this law, then you'd have to be arrested. But to arrest somebody for the first time just because they violated curfew was weak in itself. But my job was not to interpret the law, but to enforce the law. But I spent a lot of time interpreting the law. And I spent a lot of time with the white police constituencies trying to explain cultural lifestyle, cultural habits, why these people are out after 11 o'clock for lack of things to do, why these people are involved in crime because there's no jobs. And if you're idle, you have nothing to do, and sooner or later you're going to yield to the temptation of committing a crime. So it behooves them to know why people do what they do. And that's probably one reason why I quit the police department, is because too much time trying to interpret. I've always been in favor of helping or assisting young people. That's why this job, you know. But what I believed in with the too many times, you know. So I thought I could do better in another position, another capacity. Though I felt as though I'd done as much as I possibly could as a police officer.
Okay, during the, I think it's the early 30s or 40s or somewhere in there, we've been talking to other people and they said that they remember the segregation in the theaters. Were you too young?
Do
you remember that?
No, well, I'm still young. No, the problem was that segregation continued on up through the 50s. There was a section in the movies, and depending on which movies were out, or on the Orpheum Theater or the Park Theater, where blacks sat. There were stores downtown where you was treated indifferent from the regular customer. Okay. So segregation existed long up into the 50s. It didn't stop in the 30s or the 40s at all, but that thing with the movie theaters was very true. The thing with the bars was very true. The experience was in 1954, 55, J.C. Caroline dared or challenged the campus barbershop and went in for a haircut because he was a very popular athlete, you understand, and they refused to cut his hair. So that was occurring even that late. When it was a big issue, and there was newspaper articles in reference to that. But that was one of the I spent a lot of time picketing the Steak and Shake on Green Street, because they allow the black customers to drive up to and use the facilities of the drive up window, but they could not go inside. And so we went and picketed it. I was very much a part of that movement to get Steak and Shake open. I spent some time in the early 60s with Jim Ransom and some other people in the community picketing downtown. I think it was the Sears and the Penny store downstairs by hiring blacks, because blacks was, and boycotting those stores, because blacks was spending money with those franchises. So in that manner, okay, I have paid my dues. I can remember very vividly in my adolescent years when I was going into grade school, I had to go right past Metal Go Ice Cream Company, which was right on the corner of 5th and University Avenue. And they always had the sign posted in there, "We reserved the right to serve our customers," which was a selectivity thing. It was to say in a subtle manner that if you're black and we don't want to serve you and come up to this counter, no, everything was to go. In most restaurants and most places, Metal Go, like I said, I very vividly remember that. But I can also remember being a little black boy running around to the back to get the all the remains of the ice cream that was left in one of the big gallon cartons as a gesture of some compassionate white man's extension of friendship, and that was rare. You know, there was only one or two that would do that, you understand? But no, that certainly prevailed under those circumstances.
Okay, later, during the 60s, how did the civil rights movement affect the Champaign, the black community?
Okay, civil rights movement in the 60s, like, started down with picketing downtown. That was very effective. You could be very proud of Champaign Urbana because they stood up on some of the major cities. Had started in down south, they started it. And Champaign Urbana woke up. And they started picketing, they started boycotting, and the whole national fever caught on here. And this wasn't done solely by blacks. This was done with some constituency, with white people. This person's most sympathetic was probably the church people, even though there were some churches that was very obviously still racist, did not believe in such a movement. It was too soon, too much too soon, and it did not participate. One of the things that was happening during that movement was the reliance again on the black church, a place to convene, a place for the information to be disseminated to the congregations that was to participate. That's always been the crutch of black people, is black church. And so they played their role in it. But there's a lot of sacrifices made. In particular, and I want to mention this, was some of the sacrifices made by John Lee Johnson, Roy Williams, and some of those people of that age who tried to formulate and finally did formulate this plan for the EOP program, the Education Opportunities Program here on campus in 1968. Their role was a very important role because now you get the impact of 500 new students coming to campus, which is going to change a whole lot of things. They weren't any more educated than the kid is today, but they had the will to learn. I can remember persons like John Lee Johnson going out of recruiting. At that time, the EOP students come from across the country, from down south, Philadelphia, East St. Louis, St. Louis, Chicago, and New York, even. But there was the EOP program, a solid foundation was due to the community interest as well. It didn't happen. And so rarely does the community get credit for that. And this is an opportune time for me to mention that. But the EOP program did have a great impact on what's happening here, because now we have to get into the housing thing, providing the housing for blacks, because I think it was 1966 before there was even any housing that late on campus here that blacks could get into the dormitories and whatnot, you know.
Okay, previously you said that when you were in high school that mm-hmm. the counselors didn't influence the students, you know, tell mm-hmm. them what they need to take, you know, mm-hmm. in order to prepare them for college. Would you say that, you know, now that, you know, in your experiences with their children, that they
I really think, without naming individuals, without even thinking of individuals, that the counseling programs across the country, and particularly because I can witness it in Champaign, Urbana, are weak. They, for young blacks still coming out of high school, I think they do everything on automatic. I think they may be available. If you ask them a question, maybe they will answer your question, but they're not very thorough with the response. They're not very, it's my impression that they're not very sincere. It's more of a job for them than it is an interest at heart for the growth and development of young black kids coming out. I don't care how you look at it, I don't care what's offered in the high school. It still has to deal with the basics, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And if you don't have that down pat, that's just your opportunity for employment somewhere along the line, or it ill prepares you for college. Now, I've been a witness, because I know that the transition from high school to college is great in itself, but to come here unprepared at an institution of this size and with the credibility that it has, you got to be on the ball. And there's nobody out here giving away anything, because racism is just still out here, you know. So you can't perpetuate that kind of thing. I think so many kids are lost in college because they haven't been prepared in junior high and high school. So that has to happen. It doesn't start happening in high school. It has to happen when you're coming out of the K through 6 years. That career has to be geared then. So I find the counselors totally ineffective. I don't care who they are. That's what I see.
Okay, have you been a member of any organization in Champaign in the past or now?
Yes, I used to belong to, well, let's go back and start with the Boy Scouts, okay, and then let's go up. And I spent time after coming out of the service with the, used to be an AMBETS in town, the Black AMBETS on East Washington Street, 600 block. I belong to that as the historian. I have belonged and still belong to the University Elks, number 619. Though we don't have a facility, we still have the organization and some money that will tie us together still. And we meet less frequently, but it does exist. And then I was the youngest exalted ruler of the Elks in the Illinois-Wisconsin Association. I was a state officer with the Elks. I'm now affiliated with Alpha Phi Theta fraternity. I've served as Polaris of that fraternity, the graduate chapter. I'm a national officer now with the fraternity. And I'm also affiliated with the Don Morey's Boys Club of Champaign-Urbana. My present position is chairman of the board of this for the Boys Club. So that's the things that I've most directly involved with, though I've been affiliated with the NAACP, the Urban League, OIC, in whatever capacity I could have been, you know, these things I want to see grow. So as I can expand and extend myself to assist in any area, then I'm a card holder for those organizations.
Okay, do you remember, during the 60s, there was a newspaper called the Illinois Times. Do you remember that newspaper?
Vaguely, but I think that was Blanche Jameson's paper. Okay, well, I remember, yes, okay. The only problem with the Illinois Times, it was a good paper. It was unfortunately outdated news, but still news for the reader. Now that's because this beautiful lady tried to do that paper mostly by herself. And then there's always finance involved in that. And so she was the major contributor financially. So it didn't surface as strong as it should, though it did indeed have its impact, and it was good for this community. It wasn't formative. It's just a matter of distribution and all the mechanics that a large paper like the Chicago Tribune, the Sun-Times, or even the local papers had the mechanical stuff to get it out and had the personnel to get it out. But it was very significant and very impressionable for the Black community.
Okay, during the 60s, the gangs were rowdy or whatever. And, okay, I've been hearing some people say that the gangs are coming up again. Could you give your opinion of why you think they...
I haven't heard that the gangs are surfacing again, but I would not be surprised. And the gangs only happen because of one reason. I'll live and die with this. That is because there's no employment, there's no means of making a dollar except taking the dollar, being slick about getting a dollar, being influenced by drugs, the bottom line being too much idle time. If you give a child something to do, he will have a tendency to occupy his time with that. Now, one of the best things that I've seen happen right after the gangs dispersed was that the same people who was in them gangs began to play softball, constructive, positive competition in Douglas Park, and they had the league up in Douglas Park. And those same people who used to argue, fight, and shoot each other was part of a ball team. And instead of fighting and shooting, you took it out this way in some kind of positive action. Now that was important, and that was a very solid league. Even people in the community who lived as neighbors to Douglas Park began to come out and involve themselves and participate in the activities, and it became a very fun thing for them to do because it was a walking distance from home. You could enjoy the evening, you understand, wasn't in fights. It was well regulated. Bud Johnson had a lot to do with that. They wouldn't have that nonsense up there where you had to be fighting and going on. The umpire's word was the law. And it was very constructive, but it gave somebody something to do. There was no uniforms bought, there was no equipment bought by the park district. The kids got together, they chipped in, they got their own uniforms, which they wore quite proudly. They bought their own supplies, and that is another thing that you have a responsibility And if you got a responsibility and you address that, that helps you grow. That helps you develop, and that will carry over onto the job. So that was very important. I'm concerned now that that no longer exists in Douglas Park, and most of the leagues that play for the Park District are playing in Dodge Park, Dexter Field, all across Champaign. I think the rationale that the Park District comes up with is the fact that we don't want to show any separatism. But what it done was divorced the black community of having some place to go. And be amongst their people other than church. There's no place in Champaign, Alabama for people to go. I have a problem with the very fact that the young people in Champaign, Alabama have no place to go. I think that young people in Champaign, Alabama ought to have a dance every weekend if that's what they want to do. But there's no place to have that dance, you see. Douglas Center in itself as a facility is closed during the summer, and only thing is open is the park under some modified supervision. And Douglas Center should never be, in my opinion, closed. Okay. And Douglas Center is the only place to go other than church in the black community. So the overflow from the black community and the response is to come on campus with at least some alternate sites, at least some other activity, you see. Then the university gets concerned because everybody from the black community is coming over here. They understand that because they got something to offer. Northeast Champaign-Urbana does not have anything to offer, particularly to young people. The best thing they had, like I said, was that summer league up there in softball. But it's dissolved itself. And hopefully someday, soon, that there will be a petition to get that activity back up in the park. It could be separatism, it could be whatever it is, you understand. But it needs to be an outlet for people to get out of the house in Champaign, Alabama, northeast end of town. If it was a problem, that would be one thing, but there were no problems during that time. And that was a very, very good thing. Now, I don't think that Douglas Center ought to be limited to just recreational sports. I know there's overpopulation by going to Douglas Center because everybody, every age group can't play basketball at the same time. Everybody can't use one softball diamond all the time. But then the answer to that is have alternate programs. Why not have drama? Why not? I mean, there's a stage here in Douglas Center, but I don't know what it's there for. I haven't figured that out yet. They don't use it, you see. I want to know why they aren't using the stage at Douglas Center. The best thing that's coming out of Douglas Center, this is no reflection on Nate Dixon, but then again, it's the people that live in that area that are going to have to go to Nate Dixon to make him stand up as well to the parties and say, hey, there's a demand for these kind of activities and back him up. Okay. But the best thing they got going up there is senior citizens. They're quite content, it seems, and very active and use the annex well. But that's one segment of the population of Northeast Champaign. What are we going to do with the young people? And don't put on and don't perpetuate the thought that the only thing for young blacks to do is play ball or have some kind of recreation. Because see, they'll carry that over into high school. And then they'll carry that over to college and they think they're supposed to be pro. And that ain't working, you know. So we foster a lot of that ourselves. So it's time for the black community to stand up and make some demands on what should happen in Douglas Center.
Okay, so how were the job opportunities in the early years that you were for blacks?
Until affirmative action set in, There were jobs, but they weren't very meaningful jobs. They weren't any high-paying jobs. They were always in some kind of servitude capacity things that whites, as a rule, didn't necessarily want, you know. But there were jobs. Today, as we educate our people, and they become educated, there becomes less jobs. They become better qualified, and the jobs are gone, you see. Before, it was black people were less qualified, but they held down a job, which didn't pay any salaries. Now, if that much money is out there for a job now, then it stands to me, America's about white America, and they're going to get those jobs. So, that reflects on the Bakke case for someone, you know. And then the other problem that I see is those blacks that got the jobs during the 60s, forgot how they got there, aren't pushing hard enough in some areas to provide jobs for these young people today, you see. Now that's done, and there's awakening going on now by the vote. You have to vote. And young people, as they become 21, have to learn how to register to vote and do most things by the ballot to put black people in those positions. Because one of the things that's happened, like I said, is those people in the 60s that may have gotten them job opportunities are so busy protecting their own job or thinking they're protecting their own job, they don't have no time to stretch out or expand or extend themselves to reach out and bring some younger people up, you see. CETA program does quite a bit for young black people. But then I have a problem with CETA too, only because of the fact that it suggests that the only way that you can have that job is based on income. Well, now everybody that has that rate of income don't want to work no way. So they aren't getting proficiency, and it kills and denies those persons who have an income over their standards. That doesn't, I mean, they've got to live too. Now, I guess the rationale is that they got a better opportunity, but no. I think that you ought to take and offer the job to those people who want to work and have the skills to do that work, you know. But it has taken some burden off of unemployment. But it, I just don't like some of the guidelines for, you know. It certainly denies my family the opportunity to take and get a CETA job. The CETA jobs are on-the-job training, so you can learn some skills. And my kids aren't so smart they can't learn, you see. But they denied that because of my income, and I ain't rich, you see. But somebody telling me, you ain't rich, but you rich enough, you see. So that affects my children.
Okay. How would you like to see the black community, let's say, about 10 years? For instance, during our interviews, we sometimes ask the people that, and some responses have been that they would like to see the blacks maybe get together a black business store or something, you know, that all the blacks are behind, you know.
Right. One of the things about some of the blacks in this town right now is those that have businesses do not have any businesses in the black community. Of course, that's their choice, but that's what we need. I can agree with those other people. Is that first, let's deal with the Oak Ash area, which is void of housing, void of business. I don't know what it's zoned for, so surely some business in that area. But there should be some single family units, in my opinion, that's constructed there with the playground area for the kids to grow up in a healthy environment. there should be an opportunity for a business or three or four to go up in that same area. And then it would enhance those people that's across the street from that vacated area. Gene's took stop in that area to take and do more to dress up that area. You see, that kind of pressure would demand that kind of pressure. But then Gene, I'm sure, I know Gene personally, I don't know what his feelings are, but I'm, you know, if you can make money without a whole lot of overhead, you make money without a whole lot of overhead. The funeral home, you know, that's another sore spot with me. I mean, blacks are dying every day. It seemed to me that they ain't got to go to arms to bury somebody. But they have viewed Parker's because of its oldness, okay, as a place not to go because it doesn't have that appeal. It doesn't have that chapel, so to speak. It doesn't have the same provisions that Orange Funeral Home has. Now, it's sad that they don't have that because it's been there long enough, enough black people have died for that to be enriched, you see. But it's an attitude thing, I think, you know, well, so-and-so ain't doing it, I ain't doing it. But somebody has got to be first. That Oak Ash area ought to be some a cleaners there, for an example. There ought to be, we don't need no liquor stores. We drive all over town to get liquor now, so we don't need no liquor store. And, we can get to that. But it needs to be a cleaners there, for an example. That would be a positive factor. It needs to be, as promised, some single-family housing units. You know, people have been dispersed throughout this town, their property bought up, and with no place to go. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that area. That area becomes what you invest in it, what you put in. Like I said, cleaning is just one thing that could go there. A laundromat could go there. I'm sure that that newness in the barbershop over across the street would pick up, and beauty shop. All of those things that people use every day should be right there. Now, once that happens, then other blacks will see that it's an opportunity for them. Not necessarily there because that would be overcrowded by them, but they will invest in a business, you see. I think black people are leery about establishing the business because they aren't sure ever of black support, you see. But if you set the tone and you set the example that money can be made, and that would be an opportune time to do it, then it could happen. And it would act as a catalyst for other blacks to get involved. That's a sore spot for me because some development should be going on there right now. And that land's been there. Absent of housing, absent of anything for a long time. And there was money there that was allowed for that, but it's not occurred. So. I think the black church, let me just jump on this black church business just a minute. The black church has a total responsibility to the community. And I see no cohesiveness with the various churches because everybody's trying to do their thing, you see. And I don't know what part God plays in this whole thing, but sometimes I'm impressed that he's absent because there's too much competition between churches and how I can get the biggest congregation, who gonna tithe the most, that kind of foolishness, okay, versus disseminating the word about how we can get something together. If each church took its congregation, you see, and each church had the same subject matter and the same priorities, then it all could be done, you see. But the priorities are different, you see. That's indeed the problem. It always starts with the church, for black people. It always ends at the church for black people. So if you don't see progress in a black community, it's my opinion that the churches in that black community are failing. You see. So churches must take a stand, quit being selfish. They must take a stand and quit being competitive with one another. And unify and preach the same sermon about the growth and development of Champaign, no matter how it will be better for all of us versus how it will be better for my church. You see. There's a big church up on Bradley, or there's another big church somewhere else on Maine. You understand? But there's that little church down there at Third and Park, who serve the same guy, but don't prosper as well because the congregation isn't there. But I'm saying everybody ought to prosper. The big look out for the small. The strong look out for the weak, you know. And only until we have that kind of cohesiveness would it be effective. How effective would it be at a city council meeting to get the Oak Ash Project if every church and its congregation went to city council meeting? You see. Now we have a problem with representatives there of the church to go. Because it ain't affecting them directly, so they ain't going. What they going for? You see what I'm saying? But if you got the congregations of Salem, Bethel, CME, and a few others together, they could not hold nor house that multitude of persons at a city council meeting. And then those folks that are holding up the growth of Oak Ash area would pay attention. You see. It's not too late to protest, boycott, or march. You see. But that must be mentioned in church, because that's where the masses are in this town. You see. I can go out here tomorrow and start talking about having a mass demonstration, you understand? I'm going to get a few people that's going to respond, but I don't have the real mass. The real mass is in the church.
How would, if I had a question about the youth in today's society, how have they changed, you know, than the youth when you was coming back? I mean, are they more motivated, or are they trying to get out and get their education?
Oh, I think that per family, let me say it like that. So in some families in Champaign, Atlanta, they've been taught traditionally that you must go to school, okay? Because it's a family way. We've always had somebody, you know. I'm not hung up in that. I think you ought to go to school if you want to go to school, you see. But if you don't go to school, you go to work to sustain the family. Because even if you go to school, and school shows me only one thing, is that it's an opportunity to be more knowledgeable of what you intend to do. Better prepare. But then there's nothing like experience. If you go to work when you're 15 and you learn from 10 years while students are going to school, your experience is going to pay off as well. So I don't believe in forcing a kid and all the tradition about you got to go to school. School ain't for everybody. You see, because if you have no desire to go to school and you're going out of habit, you ain't going to be a burden on your family nowhere. When you finish college, you're going to do the same thing you done if you didn't go to school. You're going to work. So those that want to go to school and become better educated and seek that opportunity to make more money for what they've learned, I think that's fine. For those that don't want to go to school, they should get a job and learn from experience. Parkland provides a lot of opportunities, particularly for blacks, because it's only a two-year school, and you can learn specific things. I mean, there's technology to be learned, mechanics to be learned, nursing to be learned. Which is a career. A career is only to make money. I mean, the only thing that will keep you on this earth right now is God and money. That's all. Now, if you want to make more money, you get more proficient at what you do. But there's no reason why a person can't use their hands and make money as well as use their brain and make money. So there shouldn't be that class distinction about who went to school. A lot of people suspect that I finished the University of Illinois or I went to wherever. But I come out of high school. And I just went to work, you see. I hate the word, but for lack of a better word, the prestige that goes along with any college graduate, you understand. I'm the director of the Afro-American for that big University of Illinois, you see. But I'm just a dummy that went to work, you see. But I'm just as smart as anything that went to school, you hear me? Because I made it that way, you see. So that's my philosophy on school. I don't think that you ought to do something because somebody used to do that. You see, all you ever want as an individual is respect of another individual. That's all you want out of the whole thing. You see, because if you make a dollar, they're gonna take a dollar. It don't matter. You see.
Okay, that's all the questions we have. And if there's anything that you want to tell us that you can remember.
No, I can appreciate you getting involved because of what you're doing by getting involved is getting an education. Now, you know something about Champaign, Urbana. But it's what's happening in Champaign, Urbana is typical from wherever you may have come from in that hometown, that former hometown. So blacks as a whole have to make up their mind what they really want to do and impact it. I mean, you can talk about it for days. Our black community in Champaign-Urbana must remain in part where it is because that's where our roots is. That's where it's traditional. I can deal with tradition there. North End should never dissolve. And we got blacks all over Champaign-Urbana. But it's historically sound to refurbish, rehabilitate, and maintain, if you will, our land in Northeast Champaign. And all you do is make it better than it is. That's all. But there's no reason to go high side and jump out over Southeast Champaign. You know, stay with your people. But when you cut your grass, have that neighbor's going to cut his, you know. And then you have the same thing they got in Southeast Champaign. I mean, they compete out there. Who won't be?
This is part two of a two-part series.
You see. But, you take a gang and make a gang a positive force. The smartest people I knew was in them gangs. All they needed was have their brain power redirected in a positive nature. But through frustration, they chose that way. They weren't bad kids. They were forced into being bad kids because they was never given an opportunity. Some of the people in the gang right now are working in university. You see. They're working out here, got good jobs. And it took them a little longer to see the light. But see, them good jobs weren't available to them before. You see. All I'm saying is you give me the opportunity. I come out here in 1969-70. University, making $8,500. Now, my contention was, that was less than what I was getting paid on the police department. My contention was, that ain't no money. But my biggest goal was the fact you let me in the door. I'll make it, you know. I'm making three times as much now, you see. I have no problem with that because I, you know, what you earn. I just want my fair share because I'm going to spend it anyway. It would make a difference. If I make it $50,000, I might spend it because I'm going to live like I'm making $50,000. So raises and pay don't mean nothing to me, you know, because work has become a habit and a way of life for me. And I know that you got to make some sacrifices to get to the next step, you see. So I took a deduction in pay. So I knew one thing is that you give me the opportunity, I'll show you what I can do. You see. And I feel very good about being director of culture, so I don't want to go nowhere. You know, I'm involved in everything that's black on this campus and don't have no degree. But I know that anything that happens black on this campus, sooner or later, it's going to come to me, you know. Well, I'm going to be a part of that decision making. And that's an achievement, okay, to me. And I have no problem telling anybody who suspects that I have a degree. I don't have no degree. Don't want no degree. I had a scholarship to come here to the University of Illinois in art when I left high school. And I chose to go to the service. Degree ain't for me. I know I could be smart. But if I go to in the classroom and miss something here on these streets, you see, and this is where I have to live, is all these streets, so that's my preference, okay. All right. That's as much as I got to say. And I thank you both for interviewing me. I hope I've been some assistance, okay?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.